The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we take another look at the surprising science of water to find out what happens to the water we use after it goes down the drain. We talk to Dr. Alistair Boxall about the sources and effects of pharmaceuticals in man-made and natural water systems. But first, researcher Liz Borkowski joins us to explain why the humble toilet may just be the key to civilization. Thanks for listening. I'm speaking to Liz Borkowski. Liz is a researcher in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. She blogs at the public health blog, The Pump Handle. Thanks for being here, Liz.
Thanks for having me.
So let's just start right into it. What are some of the diseases that are transmitted through feces, and why should we be afraid of them?
Basically, the problem is diarrheal diseases. These are diseases that are spread primarily when the feces of an infected person gets into water. And then people may drink the water may get on their food, it may get on their hands. It can also be spread by flies or directly from feces to fingers to somebody else's food. So the big problem is really inadequate sanitation. And bacteria like E. coli and the cholera bacteria and also rotavirus is another big one that spreads. And the result from this is 1.5 million deaths every year worldwide from diarrheal diseases. And over 90% of those deaths are in children under five. So the toll is really alarming. And even for people who don't die, if you're in an area where you don't have clean water and adequate sanitation and you're chronically getting diarrhea as you grow up, you are more likely to be malnourished. You're probably going to be missing school. And so that's going to affect you your entire life.
Well, on the blog post you wrote about this topic, you actually had a diagram about how fecally transmitted diseases get to victims.
Sure. This is called the F diagram, and it's something that public health students will probably all see in their classes at one time or another. And it is how feces get to future victims. And basically, the routes are fluids, fingers, flies, fields, or floors, and that is often via food. And so there are a number of points at which we can cut off the transmission. And if we actually just keep the feces in a contained place to begin with, that's one of the most effective things to do, because then they're not going to be getting on people's fingers, flies are not going to be spreading it, it's not going to be getting near fields or people's homes. And then also, clean water is an important component of that as well, because you want to be drinking clean water, not water that's been contaminated with feces. And also hand washing is another point. So even if you did get feces onto your fingers, you could wash your hands and then prevent that from getting any farther. So all these interventions really work best together. If you get clean water, you get sanitation to keep feces away from the water to begin with, and you get hygiene campaigns that promote hand washing, then you will see rates of diarrheal diseases drop pretty amazingly.
Well, what parts of the world is this transmission, I guess, maybe most problematic?
Sub-Saharan Africa is really the spot where the progress has been behind on water and sanitation. And it's also a big problem in a lot of Asia, but there have been striking improvements in both China and India in recent years. And the way this is measured is by the Millennium Development Goals. So this is the United Nations set these goals and said that between 1990 and 2015, we want to meet these certain targets. And the targets for water and sanitation were to have the percentage of the population of the world that didn't have access to improved facilities. So back in 1990, 54% of the world population had improved sanitation facilities. And those are basically facilities where excrement is kept away from any sort of contact with humans or animals or insects. And the facilities have to be private rather than shared with a large public, because if you have totally public facilities, the maintenance doesn't tend to be very good. So the goal is to get 77% of the world population by 2015 to have improved sanitation facilities. And unfortunately, by 2008, only 61% of the world population had met that goal. So it's lagging behind. It may not get there. There has been an increase of 1.3 billion people who now have access to improved sanitation facilities who didn't before. But because the goal was set as a proportion of the world population, the target keeps moving, and we have to get improved sanitation to more and more people. So there's been progress, but it really hasn't been as much on sanitation. Clean water, on the other hand, has really been seeing good progress and is on track to meet the goal.
So we're talking about developing countries, but those effects don't occur just in the developing world. You mentioned in an email to our producer about an outbreak in Milwaukee in 1993.
Back in 1993, there was an outbreak of cryptosporidiosis, which basically all you need to know about that is it's diarrhea, and it's caused by Cryptosporidium oocysts. And these oocysts are found in a lot of surface waters in the U.S., and it doesn't take very many ingested to actually cause illness. So in this case, they found that Lake Michigan water was contaminated with Cryptosporidium oocysts, and it wasn't adequately removed in the water treatment facilities. And it ended up that 403,000 people experienced diarrhea, and there were 54 deaths in the 4 years following that researchers determined were probably caused by this. So this is something serious, and it is the kind of thing that, you know, we need to be grateful that this isn't happening more often, and also realize that if we do start having problems with our infrastructure and our water treatment plants, the ramifications of that can be serious.
So what does not adequately removed mean?
Well, if there are enough that will get through into people's tap water to cause illness, then not enough have been removed. Again, because the number that you need is quite low, you really need to try and get rid of all of them. Here in the U.S., the Environmental Protection Agency does set pretty stringent requirements for municipal water treatment facilities, and it's something that the facilities have to report on, whether they do an adequate job keeping Cryptosporidium out of the water supply.
So would you call that a breakdown in sanitation then?
The research into this has not specifically pinpointed a source of where this Cryptosporidium came from in the first place. So was it that people got it and the sewage system didn't deal with it appropriately and it ended up in Lake Michigan? That's not entirely clear. But basically, the water treatment and the sewage system need to work together. Sewage needs to be treated before it's discharged into a body of water, because somewhere, some city is probably drawing drinking water from that same water source.
Right.
And so we treat the sewage before we put it into the body of water, and then when we take the drinking water out of the body of water, then we treat that as well. And you really have to have both pieces working well in order to really keep the rate of disease as low as it is now in the U.S. You know, we used to have a big problem with a lot of diseases that are spread through inadequate sanitation or unclean water. And so back in the start of the 20th century, diarrhea was the third leading cause of death in the United States. And by 2000, it was not even on the list of the top 10 causes.
Go science.
Yes.
Well, moving on to other countries again, you also mentioned, actually in a post previous to the one that I was referring to, Pakistan flood victims.
Basically, any time there is a flood that really just overwhelms the system that a country might have set up, and you've got people who are, maybe they don't have the same sanitation facilities they did before, you've got large populations of people who are moving around, not in places where they were before, you may not have access to clean water, especially for all of the displaced populations, cholera is going to be a concern. Unfortunately, this is something that we did see in Haiti. We saw a big epidemic in Haiti that is still going on, although it has passed its peak and it's not spreading. They're not seeing as many new cases every week. Haiti does not have an adequate sanitation system to deal with this, but they actually did not have the cholera bacteria that was circulating around up until now. And cholera can lie dormant. Basically, it can exist in aquatic environments for a long time without ever getting into a human. But once you start getting human cases of it, and if those people don't have adequate sanitation facilities, then you can get huge bodies of water that get contaminated, and then the disease can spread very quickly. And especially in a population like in Haiti, where since the disease really hasn't been there circulating in the population, people don't have immunity to it.
Well, maybe at this point we should actually explain what qualifies as a sanitation system.
Sure. What we have, most of us, have flush toilets, and those definitely qualify, either connected to a public sewer system or septic systems. And then composting toilets, things like that, also qualify. And then latrines will qualify as long as they're not just like an open pit where the feces will sit there and flies will be going in and spreading the bacteria that's in the feces. So you can get covered pits are pretty common. You can see like a concrete slab on top of a hole, and it's got a little hole that people can squat on there. And it's important that it not be required that the feces actually be removed manually from those, because some people will set those kinds of things up. But then, of course, if you're having to remove the feces, then you're creating this opportunity for, obviously, the person who's removing it to be exposed. And then if it's going somewhere else, then that can also be an issue.
Nobody wants that job.
No. And unfortunately, in India, there are people who that is the job they're supposed to do, and they obviously have a really horrible burden of disease.
So what about those campsite toilets that are basically holes in the floor? Do they qualify as sanitation? I've always wondered that.
Well, it depends what happens with them. So if the feces go down into a pit and they're not going to be, you know, washed away and nobody is going to have to dig them out, then that shouldn't cause a problem.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And now, back to the show.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm discussing sanitation with Liz Borkowski, researcher in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. So what proportion of the world doesn't have access right now, do you think, to acceptable sanitation facilities?
So the last update on the Millennium Development Goals was using figures from 2008, and those were reported in 2010. And at that point, 2.6 billion people, which is almost 40% of the global population, did not have access to improved sanitation facilities.
So then who's working on increasing availability?
It has been a big focus for international development groups, NGOs, as well as for national governments. And I think water tends to get a little bit more of the attention. I think, especially if you're looking at just getting money from individual donors, I think people are more likely to feel like, yes, I want to give people clean water, as opposed to I want to give somebody a latrine. So we have seen a bit more eagerness to invest in water than in sanitation. But it definitely is something that governments know that it's something that will improve the health of their population, and it certainly is a goal. It has been improving more quickly generally in urban areas rather than rural areas. Rural areas are really lagging behind in sanitation.
So what's standing in the way then?
There are a few things, and actually we have to think about sustainable sanitation solutions. For those of us who have grown up with a flush toilet, we probably think, well, of course everyone wants to use that. And I think some of us have probably had that experience of going to another country and realizing, oh my gosh, I have to squat over this hole and there's no toilet paper. And it seems very upsetting to us if we're not used to that. But, you know, for people who are not used to that, they may not necessarily see that that's a big priority for them to adopt that kind of system. And actually, open defecation is a practice that's pretty common in a lot of the world. 1.1 billion people were calculated to be practicing this back in 2008. And basically, it means just walking to a secluded spot and squatting. And that means that a lot of people are potentially going to be exposed to the bacteria that are in your feces. But it's, you know, I mean, if that's kind of what you're used to, it's like, well, I'm out here in the open doing my business, and it may not seem that weird. Unfortunately, it is a problem for women and girls. They will generally try and wait until it's dark out before they go, so they won't be seen doing this. But then if they're walking to a secluded spot, they risk being assaulted. And so it's really a problem for women and girls, and also for girls when they go to school. If their schools lack separate lavatories for boys and girls, a lot of girls will drop out of school once they reach puberty. So right. This really has a lot of effects.
This is actually a much larger issue than most people recognize.
It is. It's a huge issue. It affects billions of people. And, you know, it's something that people may be a little bit uncomfortable talking about, but it's really essential that this be addressed and that more of the world's population gain access to sanitation.
In many places, NGOs and governments have built toilets and latrine systems for people, but they did go unused.
Yes. This is, again, the issue of people need to understand why they should use these things. And, you know, communicating about disease doesn't always work that well. And so part of the problem has been in the sort of top-down system where donors would say, oh, okay, well, we're just going to, you know, we know what model of hand pump and latrine we think is best, and so we're just going to go in here, we're going to install latrines for everyone, we're going to install this pump. Okay, now our job is done here. And there are a few problems with that. One is that things require maintenance. You know, latrines can be pretty simple, but you can still have parts that you need to maintain or replace. And if there's no source of those nearby, or if people don't have money for them and they don't really see the value in them, you'll have a broken pump in your village and nobody will use it. And they'll just go back to getting water from the body of water where they were getting it before. And in the case of latrines, stories out there about where little like outhouse type structures had been built for people, and they saw this as a good place to store things because, you know, if you don't have a lot of storage space and you don't see that you need to use that for sanitation, it may become really appealing to have this other use for it. And so what the response has been to that has really been now for NGOs and governments to look at demand creation. So instead of just giving people facilities to actually make them want the facilities. And then once that happens, actually in a lot of places it's turned out that people don't even need subsidies. Even in very poor areas, people will figure out a way to get the supplies they need to create latrines or toilets or whatever they determine is best for their particular circumstances.
Well, tell me about that process, because you wrote about that and I found it fascinating.
Yeah, so there's this really interesting approach to this called community-led total sanitation. And a man named Kamal Kaur and his group in Bangladesh created this back in 1999. Basically, the goal that they set is to make communities open defecation free. And the way they get this started is facilitators will actually go to a community and they will ask people to take them on a tour of the places where people defecate. Then as the villagers are going and showing them this, they start feeling really embarrassed about it. And then the facilitators will take them through a mapping exercise and map, okay, where are people defecating openly and where are your water supplies, where are your homes, what happens in the rainy season. And people will basically come to this realization that they're ingesting each other's feces. And then at that point, they are motivated to change and they want to stop that. Then the facilitators basically just are there to help the community come up with their model of how they want to do this. And communities have generally responded by creating some kind of committee, and they will decide as a group on what kind of model they want. Do they want a particular style of latrine? How are they going to get the parts for this? Or, you know, help each other build them. And then one of the other interesting things is that they also need to enforce that. And so they will monitor whether people are defecating out in the open or whether they're actually using the facilities. Because even, you know, even if you want the facilities at one point, people may start just going back to old habits, as many of us often do when we try and make a health change in our lives. So in some villages, they have gotten groups of children together who will actually go, and they'll go out with whistles and signs, and they'll try and catch people who are defecating out in the open. And
oh,
then if
my.
They catch somebody, they'll blow their whistles and embarrass them, and they might even plant a little flag there to say somebody was defecating in this spot. You know, some villages will fine people for it, or they'll give rewards to people who report people who are defecating in the open. So it really, once it becomes a community priority, the community will figure out how to make it happen. And it's been very successful in Bangladesh, in other Asian countries, and it has been introduced also now in Ethiopia, Ghana, Kenya, Nigeria, and Sierra Leone.
You know, all I'm thinking at this moment is poop mapping and shame.
That's, yes.
That is brilliant.
Basically. And there's also the idea that you can make a toilet something desirable. And so there's one state in India where they actually launched a campaign called No Toilet, No Bride. And basically it says to men, if you want to marry a woman, you need to provide her with a toilet. And so they have posters and radio jingles, and there's even been a plot on a soap opera that has hinged on this. And during the first 2 years of the campaign, they constructed 1.4 million toilets. And hopefully, if it becomes something where women are saying, well, I won't marry you unless you give me a toilet, hopefully then they will see that as something valuable and really be using it.
So do you think other communities will adopt that tactic?
I don't know. I have really only read about the one report of it. But I think there are also more subtle ways to go about it. You know, just if it becomes a sort of status symbol to have a toilet, then it may become more desirable. And there are also a lot of cases where, you know, if people are sort of tracking, you know, the rates of diarrheal illness in their villages, and they realize that once we get sanitation improvements, that the rates of these diseases are dropping, then that also becomes a powerful motivator. And so if you've got someone in a neighboring village saying, oh, well, you know, we stopped having this problem, or we have doctors are seeing a much smaller percentage of patients with diarrheal illnesses, we don't have to spend as much money treating diarrhea, then that kind of testimonial can become very powerful.
I'm very much enjoying the diversity of tactics involved here.
Yes, people can be very creative about it, and I'm sure there are many more that we don't even know about.
So what do you think that people should really know about this issue?
Well, I think, for one thing, those of us who take it for granted should appreciate the fact that, you know, we have this water and sanitation system that really allows us to be much more free from these terrible and sometimes deadly diseases than a lot of other parts of the world, and hopefully that will change. We also do need to think about how much water are we using on these kinds of things, and do we necessarily need to flush the toilet if there's only urine in the toilet, and do we need to move more to maybe composting toilets and that sort of thing, because certainly there is an issue with water availability worldwide, and we're only going to have more pressure on the water supply. So it's something that, you know, we should be grateful for what we have, but we may also need to think about, okay, what do we need to be doing in the future?
Well, you did title your piece In Praise of Toilets.
Yes, they are a wonderful thing, and we all need to appreciate that.
So I'd like to end this interview on an odd note. This question is from Ryan, our fantastic studio tech and research assistant. He asks, is there any truth that the inventor of the flush toilet was named Thomas Crapper?
I'm afraid that is not actually true. The toilet actually predates Thomas Crapper by a couple of centuries, and it actually goes back to probably around 1600. In England, they started using something called a water closet, where you actually could basically use water to flush away feces. And unfortunately, when that happened, they didn't have a sewage system in place that was designed to deal with that. So what that basically meant in some places was that people were flushing toilets or the precursor of toilets out and basically putting their feces into the streets for everyone else to enjoy.
Enjoy.
Yes. And that was before they actually realized that diseases like cholera were caused by fecal contamination of water. They actually thought they were spread by smells in the air.
We've come a long way, baby.
We have.
Liz, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks very much for having me.
That was Liz Borkowski, researcher in the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at the George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. She blogs at the public health blog, The Pump Handle. We've linked to it on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back with Dr. Brian Boxall on pharmaceutical contamination in the water supply after the break.
Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Our guest is Alistair Boxall. Alistair is an environmental chemist with research interests in the fate, behavior, and effects of pesticides, biocides, veterinary medicines, and industrial chemicals in the environment. He's a senior lecturer in the Environment Department at the University of York in the UK. Welcome to the show, Alistair.
Hi.
So can you tell us a bit about the areas that you've personally been involved in researching, specifically those that relate to environmental contaminants?
I mean, I've been looking at pharmaceuticals now for about 10 years. We first started looking at veterinary drugs in the environment and trying to understand how veterinary pharmaceuticals transfer from soils to surface waters following manure application to land. More recently, we started to look at human drugs in the environment. We've done some work in Canada, actually, looking at application of biosolids to fields. And that is a route of entry of human drugs to the environment. We're doing a little bit of work looking at emissions from wastewater treatment plants to surface waters. More recently, we're starting to look at how drugs interact with organisms in the environment and how they take up into organisms and food chains.
And this is why you're perfect to be on this show, sir. We want to talk about all of those things. So maybe let's just clarify. When we say contaminants in water, we're not just talking about municipal drinking water. So what are we talking about?
Yeah, I mean, it's a combination, really. Obviously, drinking water is one aspect, but in terms of pharmaceuticals, there's concern about potential impacts on surface waters themselves, so rivers, lakes, and also when we release a pharmaceutical to the sewage system, they can transfer from the water phase into the sludge during the treatment process. And in many countries, that sludge is applied to land as a fertilizer, so there's a route of entry to the soil environment as well.
Well, and since I enjoy defining terms, when we say water contaminants, we're not just talking about flushing your antibiotics down the toilet. What are the major sources of contamination, would you say?
I mean, pharmaceuticals in the environment will come from two main sources. So There's obviously the pharmaceuticals we use. When we take a pharmaceutical, we'll probably absorb some of it into our body. We might metabolize it to some degree, and then we'll excrete the parent compounds and any metabolites down the toilet, basically. We can also, obviously, if we've got unused drugs, some people also throw those down the toilets. You might throw them into your bin that end up in a landfill. There's a potential emissions from hospitals, so if you've got a big hospital using lots of drugs, obviously that's going to be a source of potential inputs to the environment. And then more recently, people started thinking about the manufacturing processes, so there's quite a lot of work being done in India at the moment, actually, in some of the manufacturing areas where these drugs are made. We find quite high concentrations of drugs being sort of emitted to certain waters in those areas. So that's the human area. The other area is the veterinary use. So we use a lot of antibiotics and also antiparasitic compounds to treat our farm animals. Again, once they're applied to the animal, they might be absorbed, might be metabolized. And again, you've got the animals excreting the parent compound and the metabolite. Usually what we'll do with animal manure is collect it, and then it's used as a fertilizer.
So would fertilizer and pesticides, I guess non-animal-based fertilizer and pesticides, be considered pharmaceutical contaminants as well?
No. It only the use of the term veterinary pharmaceutical would be compounds that are used to treat disease in animal groups. So that would include antibiotics and some of the antiparasitic compounds.
Let's start with municipal water supplies. So what kind of pharmaceuticals end up in our drinking water?
Oh, it's a real mixture. We've got things like the synthetic hormones, antidepressants, antibiotics, anti-inflammatory drugs, beta blockers. And pretty much, if you look at the list of all the drugs that we use, probably all of them will get to the natural environment in some concentration.
So how do we know that? How do we know that those drugs are in our water system?
Well, until sort of 10 or 15 years ago, it was actually very difficult to establish whether these things were there or not. But about 20 years ago, environmental laboratories got access to something called liquid chromatography mass spectrometry. And this allowed us to go out into the natural environment to begin to detect these substances. The advantage of these instruments is that they're very specific, so we can sort of be fairly confident that what we're seeing is indeed what we think it is. And they're also very, very sensitive. So it can bring us down to the sort of types of levels that pharmaceuticals occur at in the environment.
So now this is the research that you personally were involved with as well.
We've done a little bit of that, but probably the first work was done in Germany. There was a very active group in Germany in the late 90s who went out, took lots of samples from surface waters in Germany, and measured lots of different pharmaceuticals in the surface waters. And since then, that's been done all over the world. So there's monitoring studies being done in the States, Canada, in Asia. Again, pretty much, you name the geography, it's probably being looked at.
So we do know it's there, but what's the concentration on average? And assuming there are no safety breaches.
The concentrations are generally very, very low. The unit we're talking about is usually nanograms per liter. So that's 10 to the minus 12. Per gram per liter. So it's tiny concentrations of these things.
Now, being that there are trace amounts, I guess really the big question is, what effect do pharmaceuticals in that concentration have on people?
Well, with the people, you need to bear in mind that once the drug is emitted to surface water, usually that they'll be transported the drug from the point of emission to the point of extraction, you know, it's extracted for drinking water. In most countries, the extracted water will be treated, so it will go through a number of treatment phases, which will help to remove some of the pharmaceuticals. And probably by the time it gets to your tap, the concentrations are in very low nanogram per liter levels. Now, if you compare those concentrations with the amounts that you will take when you're taking a pill of these pharmaceuticals, it's a very, very small amount, and you probably need to drink thousands of liters of water to get the equivalent dose to what you've taken, something like an aspirin or a paracetamol.
Now, that's even antibiotics? Because media does sometimes present this as contributing to the development of antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Yeah, I think the levels in drinking water would be so low that it's probably the actual currents of the drug in drinking water wouldn't be particularly important in terms of selection of resistance. Because you need a certain concentration of the antibiotic to actually be able to select for the resistant bacteria.
And we have a question from Joan Teak.
Do hormone contaminants have any effect on human fertility?
Again, I mean, probably in terms of environmental exposure and drinking water, the levels are very, very small. So I suspect that it's unlikely that drinking water would be an important boost for that.
Now, are we talking about short-term or long-term?
I mean, that's one of the big problems, is the fact that obviously when we take a pill, it will usually be for a short-term. Whereas in terms of being exposed to these things in the environment, we're actually being exposed continuously. And this is one of the big problems that we have to deal with in the sort of science area.
So at this point, I guess, what is the longest-term study that's been done in this area?
I mean, probably in terms of environmental effects, so this is effects on organisms in the environment, the longest-term study is probably a couple of years. People have done studies where they've taken fish through a number of life cycles and looked at the effect of the compound on those fish. So they would usually last for a year or two at most.
And we have a question from Lucas.
Is there a difference in the drugs found in tap water compared to bottled water?
I've not actually seen any data on levels in bottled water, but I'd imagine that bottled water would generally be taken from aquifers, so it's a slightly different route by which the pharmaceutical needs to get to the aquifer. So I would guess that the concentrations would probably be lower in bottled water. You might also find slight differences in the relative concentrations of the compounds in bottled water.
And we have another question from the chat.
Does the fluoridation of water react in any way with the pharmaceuticals in the water? That's from Aaron.
There is a little bit of concern now. So there's some work being done in Switzerland. So it's not looking at fluoridation specifically, but it's looking at other chemical treatment methods for drinking water. And there is a little bit of concern from that work that some of the chemical oxidation methods that are used for drinking water treatment might turn pharmaceuticals into other compounds that actually might be more hazardous than the parent compound.
And another question from Kat Morgan from Facebook.
What is the best, most responsible way of disposing of expired medications? I understand flushing them is a no-no, so what to do?
Well, in the UK, we're very lucky. I'm not sure about Canada or certain sort of states in the US, but in the UK, if we have unused medicines and we take them back to the pharmacist, the pharmacist legally has to take those medicines and dispose of them properly. So they'd be disposed of to hazardous waste. Now, I think there are some initiatives in the US in some areas to sort of put these schemes in voluntarily. But really, if those schemes are in operation, then that's the best way to get rid of them.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and my guest is Alistair Boxall, environmental chemist and senior lecturer in the Environment Department at the University of York. Today's episode is all about pharmaceutical contaminants in the water system. Now, municipal water systems and sanitation are fascinating, absolutely. And I mean that sincerely, actually. But we recruited you for the show specifically for your research on what happens outside those systems. So your research into veterinary medicine as a contaminant. Can you explain the process by which pharmaceuticals make their way from the animals elsewhere, first of all?
With the veterinary drugs, as I said earlier, what will happen is the drug will be administered to the animal. The animal will then excrete the drug and any metabolite. And if the animal's on pasture, then obviously that would be excreted directly to the soil. If it's an intensive operation, then usually the manure will be collected, it will be stored, and then it will be applied to the soil as a fertilizer. Now, once it's on the soil, lots of things can happen to it. So the bacteria in the soil might degrade the compounds. The compound might stick to the soil particles and be bound up, or it might be transported to surface waters, so you may get runoff of water over the soil surface, which will carry the drug from the soil to adjacent streams and ditches. And if you've got a sort of nice mixed soil with an aquifer below it, you might get leaching of the drug down through the soil to the groundwater during periods of rainfall.
We have a question, actually, back to municipal water systems. I have a feeling we'll come back to this throughout. It's a question from Beer Will.
You said the levels are incredibly low as far as human consumption. What about small animals and pets, or even insects? Can they be affected by these low doses?
It really depends on which system you're talking about. Certainly in the surface waters, potentially there could be effects on invertebrates like insects. But again, the concentrations tend to be quite a lot lower than concentrations where you see those effects in the laboratory. For veterinary use, I mentioned earlier that quite a lot of parasiticide compounds are used in veterinary medicine. There is concern there that when the animals excrete those compounds in the dung, the dung is a sort of home for things like dung flies and dung beetles. There is concern that these drugs are affecting the populations of flies and beetles in those sort of systems.
Well, now, you have definitely done the majority of your research, it seems, in veterinary areas specifically. So can you tell us about the most recent studies?
The most recent studies, actually, we've been looking at human pharmaceuticals. And the thing that we're particularly interested in is the movement of the pharmaceutical from water and sediment into organisms. So we look at things like shrimps and sediment-dwelling worms, and we try and understand the movement of the pharmaceutical from the water or the sediment into the organism. The reason we're doing that is we think that if we can understand how things get into the organism, and we can then combine that information with information on how the compound works in humans, then we might be able to begin to predict which species are at risk and which systems are at risk, and begin to sort of better assess what potential impacts of these things might be on the environment.
Well, would you be willing to sort of hazard a hypothesis at the moment? What do you think you're going to find?
Well, we're already finding that based on the chemical properties of a pharmaceutical, we can begin to get quite a good idea of whether it's going to get into an organism and what's going to happen to it in the organism. As I said, if we can then combine that information with the toxicological data on the mode of action of the pharmaceutical, then we can begin to assess which compounds perhaps pose the greatest risk to a system.
Now, you actually did similar research looking at veterinary medicines going from soils into plants. Can you tell us about that?
This was work we did about 5 years ago, and it was done for the UK government. At that stage, the UK government wanted really to know whether human exposure to veterinary medicines in the environment was something they should be worried about. So we did a number of pieces of work. So we looked at movement to drinking water, and we also looked at uptake into crops. In those experiments, we spiked soil with a range of veterinary drugs, and then we grew lettuce and carrots on the soil. And then we analysed the lettuce and carrots once they'd reached the full size. We analysed them for the different drugs that we'd spiked into the soil. And from that data, we were then able to compare that with data on human toxicity to get an idea of whether human exposure to pharmaceuticals in plant material might pose a risk to human health. Well, the conclusion was that probably it couldn't, because again, just like the drinking water, the concentrations in the crops were much, much lower than concentrations that would need to have any effect on humans.
Now, you had to develop new models to study this.
They were quite simple models, but yes, we had to develop models for estimating concentrations of these things in soil, estimating concentrations in the plants, and then estimating what the dose a human would get when they ate those plants.
Well, what were the models that were used before that? What was wrong with them, or was there anything wrong with them?
Well, really, no one had considered it before. While lots of work had been done on things like pesticides and persistent organic pollutants, people hadn't really thought about what potential exposure to things like veterinary pharmaceuticals and also human pharmaceuticals by crops would be. So it hadn't really been looked at before.
Well, now you mentioned the low concentrations again. So there's not necessarily an effect on humans at that sort of first stage. But let's say, how about to the wildlife that drinks the water?
Again, I think probably wildlife exposure to pharmaceuticals in water, the risks are probably quite low. We are beginning, however, to think about potential movements of the pharmaceutical up through the food chain. You do find with some pharmaceuticals you get sort of a magnification of the concentration of the pharmaceuticals you move up the food chain, which could mean that things like birds and other wildlife feeding on insects and other invertebrates might receive a higher dose than you'd see in water, for example.
Actually, we have a question that's sort of on that topic.
Bill Thompson from Ontario asks, studies have shown that wastewater from municipal sewage treatment plants have been shown to disrupt the endocrine systems of fish, causing feminization of male fish. Do you consider those studies reliable? What specific pharmaceutical would cause that?
Well, there's actually quite a lot of evidence now that that does happen. This feminization of male fish was observed probably as far back as the 1990s, early 1990s, and there's been some very good studies now to show that that is indeed happening. The compounds that we think are probably contributing to it also received the name of endocrine disruptors, which is a group of quite a diverse set of compounds. And one example of an endocrine disruptor is the active ingredient in the contraceptive pills, that's Epinar estradiol. And that's a compound that people are looking at in a lot more detail. So, for example, there was a study a few years ago in Canada where Epinar estradiol was added to one of the experimental lakes in Ontario to look at the effects of the compound on the population of the lake. And that sort of indicated that if you have levels slightly higher than you'd see in the natural environment, then you would get effects on fish populations over time.
So let's go to plants. Are they affected by the low doses of pharmaceuticals in water?
This is an area where we know less, although there is a little bit of data that suggests that when you expose plants to antibiotics, you get a reduction in the growth. And we think the reason this is happening is that the plants have a similar biochemistry to the microbes that the antibiotics are targeted to. So for some antibiotics, you do see the pressure in the growth of the plants at the types of concentrations that would be added to soil.
And we have another question from the chat. We have Brad in Reno.
What measures have been instituted to reduce the contamination, or are they even necessary, given the low levels?
At the moment, the only real example I'm aware of where measures have been implemented to reduce contamination is in the UK. There is a demonstration program in one of our catchments looking at the endocrine disruptors in particular. In that catchment, what they're doing is they're altering the sewage treatment methods so that they remove the endocrine disruption. And they're hoping that that will then remove the sort of pressure on the fish. But I think elsewhere, there's not really any other initiatives that I'm aware of where people are sort of really trying to reduce the emissions in the environment, apart from these take-back schemes that I talked about earlier.
Now, have you found that these contaminants sort of vary by region?
Yes, definitely. Where you've got large populations, that's where you'll find the highest concentrations of these things. You'll also find differences between wider geographies, so in areas where perhaps you've got water shortages, you've got less dilution. So again, you'd expect concentrations to be higher.
And you've actually been doing some research on the effects of climate change on this.
We've been considering how climate change might impact the use of pharmaceuticals and also other chemical contaminants, and also how it might affect the cycling of contaminants around the environment, and finally how it could affect the sort of ecology of the environment and what that would mean in terms of sensitivity to pharmaceuticals and other toxicants.
Can you talk about any of those results, or is it still too early?
At the moment, there's no sort of real experimental work we're doing. It's more so trying to identify what we think are the key issues. I think our general conclusion is that probably the inputs of many chemicals to the environment are likely to increase in the future due to increasing disease pressures and changes in socioeconomics. The way that things move around the environment is pretty likely to change. You see in the UK we're predicting more flooding, so that will probably have an effect on the hydrology of systems and how chemicals are transported. And then obviously as things get warmer, probably the ecology of streams and rivers is going to change, and that's going to then have an impact on the sensitivity of ecosystems.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. and I'm discussing pharmaceutical contaminants in the water system with Alistair Boxall, environmental chemist. And we'll be right back with more after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, it's an hour on the blood that runs through your veins and how modern medicine can supplement your supply. We'll talk to Holly Tucker about blood work, her book exploring the pioneering science and the political intrigue behind the world's first blood transfusions. And Skepticality co-host Robin Swoopy McCarthy shares her experience training as a phlebotomist. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 Mountain Time at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We're talking about pharmaceutical contamination in the water supply, and my guest is Alistair Boxall, environmental chemist and senior lecturer in the Environment Department at the University of York in the UK. I've noticed you've been very careful, and in some of the interviews I've read with you as well, to avoid overstating the research. You seem to be worried that the public will become overly concerned?
Yes, I think we have to be quite careful how we present our research. Because obviously, I mean, pharmaceuticals are very important in terms of human health and also animal health. So it's very dangerous, I think, sort of scaremongering when it comes to presenting our research.
Well, your research group was one of the first in the world to start working in this area, correct?
Yes.
So what was the reception like to your work?
Initially, I guess the industry were not particularly happy that we were sort of looking at these things in detail. I found that over the last 10 years, that's totally changed, and the attitude of the pharmaceutical industry towards the whole area of pharmaceuticals in the environment is actually very good. They're sort of putting a lot of resource into understanding the impact of their products on the environment.
Well, how much controversy is there on this topic at the moment? And I'm speaking of scientific controversy, not political controversy, if we can actually tease those apart.
I don't really think there is a lot of controversy. I think most scientists who are researching the area will acknowledge that probably the vast majority of pharmaceuticals that we use today occur in the environment at concentrations very, very low. So potential impacts of single pharmaceuticals are probably very small. I think we all recognise that there might be one or two compounds that may be a concern. And I think there are sort of topics that we all agree that are worthy of further research. So one area is this idea of the long-term exposure to these compounds and what the potential impacts of that exposure is. And the other thing you need to think about is the environment is exposed to a mixture of these things. And when we're testing these things in the laboratory, what we tend to do is just work with single compounds. So people are beginning to think about what potential interactions of those mixtures might be.
You may not be an alarmist, but I did notice in my research that your work has been cited by groups who are unconcerned about alarming the public. And in fact, I actually believe that's their goal. Have you seen that?
You do occasionally see in papers people, I think, trying to hype things up a little bit too much, in my view.
Now we have a question from the chat.
Have traces of illegal substances been found in water? And that's from SF.
Yes. First study actually came out of Italy. So it's the River Po in Italy. And in that particular study, what they did was monitor cocaine and its metabolites, and they detected the compounds. And actually what they did was, based on the concentrations they were measuring, they were able to work backwards and calculate what the amount of drug use was in that particular area.
Really?
Match that in with the police statistics, and they didn't agree.
We have another question from the chat. It's from Matter.
Is there an estimation on what levels of pharmaceuticals would be a danger to human, animal, or plant life?
Well, that's a tough one. It would be very pharmaceutical specific. So different compounds would obviously have different activities. Now, for humans, we probably do have that data, because a drug will have to go through extensive testing before it's authorized for use. And as part of that testing, they will set limits in terms of acceptable daily intakes for humans. So, you know, we will know that for humans. For the compounds, the companies do now have to do testing on effects on algae, fish, and invertebrates before a drug is authorized. So again, we have an idea of what the potential toxicity of these compounds to organisms in the environment is. But it is very compound specific.
Now, has research been done in these areas, specifically in developing countries?
Well, that's something that is really started in the last two or three years. And I think I mentioned at the start the manufacturing sites in India. This is a topic that's receiving quite a lot of attention because manufacturing of pharmaceuticals in the past has been done in developed countries. What's happening now is it's being exported to countries like India and China. And in some of these areas, particularly India, the level of control is probably less than you would get in developed world. And some monitoring, it was a Swedish group went out to India a few years ago and took samples from sites where this manufacturing was being done. And they found very, very high levels of antibiotics in the liver.
We have a question by email from Melissa.
How much of the chemicals we're seeing in the environment is just a result of better detection methods rather than increased amounts of the drugs?
That's a very good comment. Again, as I said at the start, the reason that we've been able to do this monitoring is that we've had access to the analytical technology. These things have probably always been in the environment since they've been used. It's just we haven't had the technology to look for them. So it is very much technology-driven. And I think what will happen is as we go on in time, the instruments will get better. So we'll get better at detecting these and we'll find more and more of these things.
In my research, I definitely looked at a lot of sites that are claiming that the pharmaceutical levels in our water are hurting us in some way. Do you get the impression that the average Joe has a realistic understanding of the level of danger within the ecosystem potentially?
I don't think they do. And I think that's partly our fault as scientists, because I don't think we really communicate our data as well as we should do.
So as other scientists do listen to this program, what would you advise them?
My advice is that when you write a paper and you're presenting monitoring data, we have a duty to always put that monitoring data into some context and actually draw some conclusion from it. A number of studies will just sort of present the monitoring data and sort of raise issues, and they won't attempt to put it into context.
So what conclusion would you leave the audience tonight with then?
My conclusion is that if you look at the data that have come out, probably pharmaceuticals in the environment, people in drinking water, probably pose at a low risk to human health. Generally, I think that pharmaceuticals in surface waters probably pose a low risk to surface waters and other organisms. But there are probably a handful of substances that might be of concern, and probably we should be looking at those in more detail. And I think there are also some outstanding questions that we really need to tackle. The issue of this long-term low-level exposure is one of those. And the other, I think, is this whole area of mixture interactions for pharmaceuticals and other chemicals.
Well, we'll do our best to get the word out. And thanks very much for being here, Alistair.
That's no problem.
You can find links to Alistair's work on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to Twitter, to Facebook, and to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking online. Reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan. Who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier. Reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell. Metaphorically, that is. Cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR, 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Lisa Skovanek. Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.